Evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 548, and it's June the 6th, 1982. Yet, what happened? And this is a small community, and you have to be very careful about what you say until you're really sure of what happened. I am with my research, and there's no reason not to be about the station. After being on there 11 and a half years, there were three factors involved. I suggested last week there was what was going on at the station at the time, which was very positive about the program and the format of World Watchers, and then a visit by a suspicious person who had been high up in the intelligence for 40 years who came to my home the Friday before that weekend when it was canceled, the program. And then the way it happened, I am very vague about this because for a while I have to remain that way. I did go over the station this week, and I'm convinced that no amount of letters or telephone calls, and there were literally hundreds, is going to change. It had to be off the air, and that's it. And from what follows, we'll see later on. I'll know more about it in a while, even if it takes several years to find out the answers do come in, particularly when it happens the way it did. It's interesting, the San Jose Mercury called me, one of the editors or managers of that paper. Carmel is a busy little community. It's a small town. San Jose is a larger metropolitan area, actually larger than San Francisco now, about 100 miles from here. And they called me by Wednesday and said, "We understand you're not on KLRB anymore." And I said, "That's right." And they wanted to know what stations in the area, Bay Area, there the program was still on. And they were going to put an article in the San Jose Mercury Monday about the other programs, the World Watchers, that are on in that area. I didn't think it was that newsworthy for them to pick it up that fast. And it was interesting to me because he referred to the article that Jill Wolfson did in the San Jose Mercury, the cover story in the magazine section, about 2 months ago. And I was even apprehensive when she came here because these things tell more people about your program, but they also bring a reaction. They turn people on and you want new listeners, but then there's some counteraction that happens afterwards. And one of the things that she held up the distribution of the article or the printing it was, she wanted to know how many World Watchers I have, how many people listen to the program, how many tapes go out, and who they go out to. And I said, "Well, that is really none of your business. I'm only on the air to share my research with those who want it, and I'm not at liberty to tell you, and I wouldn't tell you if I knew, but there's no way of knowing." So just before it went to print, the editor of the San Jose Mercury called me, and they wouldn't go to print unless I told them how many. And I said, "I don't want the article. Forget it." It turned out not even to be a good article, but it did mention KLRB and some stations up in the Bay Area. And I said, "Just scratch it off. I couldn't care less. And don't bother with it." But they went ahead and printed it anyway. And this Sunday's San Francisco Examiner and Chronicle, there's an article about the radicals in the 60s and the free speech movement at Berkeley. Mario Savio he's now 39. He led the protests and the anti-war activity in the free speech movement and the campus. And the FBI has now revealed documents that papers in Berkeley got on the free speech movement. And in those documents, there were memos of J. Edgar Hoover going back to 1960. This is before the Kennedy assassination and before the war in Vietnam had really escalated as of 1964. And in a confidential memo, May 13, 1960, J. Edgar Hoover told the San Francisco office that there's an organization of less than 1% of the student body composed not of the Communist Party, but of free-thinking people and students in the area, and that they should cover their activities at school, and they followed DeSavio when he traveled around the country. This is before the anti-war movement. And DeSavio says when he arrived in New York airport, this is in the early years, there was a press conference for him, and there were special agents of the FBI under the guise of newspaper reporters, and they set up a press conference, and they asked him how many communists were in the free speech movement, and he wasn't even aware or working with communists, but they tried to link him to communists, but they disguised themselves as reporters to get information about his activity and his organization, even though They knew that they were, in quotes, free-thinking people, even socialists or Marxists or students. They couldn't label them, but less than 1% of the student body listened, and therefore they had to begin their FBI memos on Savio. So people disguised as friends are sometimes newspaper reporters, and the reaction you get to becoming more listened to, people catching on to what I've been saying for years. I was getting a wider audience of all ages, and I'm getting letters and calls from people who understand now what I've been trying to say for the past years. So as you get a larger audience, you expect some kind of reaction. And I'm not sure that's what caused it, but I have a pretty good idea, and as time goes on, I'll share more that I find out with you. This week on television, there was the great one-hour movie on J. Edgar Hoover, and the American Broadcasting Company had to put that on to show, again, Lee Harvey Oswald saying he was a Marxist and standing in front of the International Trademark. And they left out a good part of J. Edgar Hoover's real activities, and I remember going back to the sheets of past tapes that I have. Many of you may have the list, the inventory of tapes. In 1977, August 1977, I did a program, number 284, we're on 548 now, J. Edgar Hoover's Nazi Connections, the Nazis in South America and in America, and the Nazis from Germany with J. Edgar Hoover. And in 1977, in October, I did a program, part of the program was on ABC Broadcasting, Selling Lee Harvey Oswald's Guilt. So it's 5 years later, and American Broadcasting is still trying to sell the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist, and not explaining why J. Edgar Hoover would cover that up just when he's looking for communists under every rock. But the role of J. Edgar Hoover in Interpol and with the Nazi organizations is the best-kept secret, except among certain researchers, and this program was the first one to even suggest that he used too much power in the agency. There was an article in Gung Ho that I referred to several weeks ago on program 545 about why William Seymour called the CIA's Man for All Nations. And in the July issue of Gung Ho, which is an interesting magazine put out in Derby, Kentucky, Charlton Building, if you want to order it, Derby, Kentucky, 06418, you can write and send for copies. A new subscription is $14 for 6 issues. They advertise, get there quick with Gung Ho. This is July issue. Do you crave fast action? And it tells how to fight in Afghanistan, Africa, Central America, and so forth. Read what the professional reads and learn tricks that keep you alive to fight another day. From mercenary operations to Africa to presidential guards in America. And I'm sure they're referring to guards such as those that, in quotes, protected John Kennedy or even Ronald Reagan with the double shooting, the possible double or triple assassins right there at the Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C. in March last year when Ronald Reagan was shot. This magazine, the articles that I have from May, June, and July seem to be very honest, direct articles with some good information in them, and I'll be doing some more with you about these articles. But they're advertising how to operate as presidential guards in America. Now, J. Edgar Hoover, the part they didn't show in the movie, was active in the organization Interpol, and I'll do a detailed broadcast on that again for you. I haven't done one in the last 3 or 4 years. Hoover was affiliated with Interpol as early as 1935. He had direct contacts with them, and this was the international police that Hitler founded in the 20s after they began rearming Germany. He had direct communication with the high officials, Mr. Oscar Dressler and Mr. Heydrich, the Reinhard Heydrich, the chief of the Nazi police, and the beginning of, he was the one who began the Jewish solution of killing all the Jews that they had on the continent of Europe and elsewhere if they conquered that. Heydrich was president of Interpol from 1940 to 42. Hoover had to lose his connections in 1941 after Pearl Harbor was bombed because he had pictures of Nazis in his office. And after Heydrich was assassinated in 1942 in Germany, Ernest Kaltenbrunner took over the Interpol presidency, and then he was hung for war crimes at Nuremberg in 1946. But in 1946, J. Edgar Hoover became the vice president, taking over the old files of Jews to be exterminated. And these files are on microfilm and are, I understand, are still kept very much intact and are used by hit squads. And a Mr. Bauman was chief of the Secret Service in the United States. He was elected as vice president to Interpol. So when Gung Ho advertises how to operate with presidential guards in America, and when the chief of our Secret Service in the United States is vice president of an organization that worked with the Gestapo before and after the war, and J. Edgar Hoover became vice president of Interpol after the war in close affiliations with the Nazis continuously, you can understand how easy it is to off a president and have all the information of where he'll be and cover it up. And J. Edgar Hoover, of course, was the man described, at least in this program, as saying the lone assassin, that Oswald was the loner. And they tried to explain on ABC that maybe he was covering up for the mafia, the organized crime syndicate that didn't like the Kennedy brothers, or he was covering up for Fidel Castro and the Russians. Well, I hardly believe that's the case. But by making Oswald the loner, they could divert all the Nazi connections that I've dealt with many times on this program and will always in the future. So the program shows J. Edgar Hoover with some of his flaws in 1 hour, but of course leaves out the Secret Service and Interpol. As far as the Kennedy assassination, the role, or J. Edgar Hoover's role in covering up who killed John Kennedy, and it leaves out the Nazi connections that is the real secret to J. Edgar Hoover. And part of the movie also showed, this movie this week, showed that J. Edgar Hoover was feeding the anti-communist literature and fires to Senator Joe McCarthy, and Senator Joe McCarthy was also getting this from Georgetown University, and members of the Vatican Secret Military, Sovereign Military Order of Malta. And I want to do more on that this evening, part two of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. I mentioned it last week, part one, the men behind the Counter-Reformation. This is an article by Kevin Coogan, C-O-O-G-A-N, published by Jonathan Marshall in his newsletter of February 1982. And he talks about members of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, which is a second branch of the Vatican. There is the religious, theological branch, and there's the military branch. And many people are not familiar with the military branch. And it's an important thing because it seems that the head of Hitler's intelligence agencies and our CIA and the men directing foreign policy today are all part of this organization. And it's important because in this country, theoretically, we should have a separation of church and state, but are we using the network of the Vatican locations of various people from the Vatican who had a network of their Catholic organization set up and an overlay of the Odessa, the Otto Skorzeny, Martin Bormann network that would take over and keep the Fourth Reich living? Did they slip the Odessa into the Vatican gown and use our high intelligence people from the OSS and the CIA and Hitler's intelligence combined under the cloak of the Vatican for control of the world and the Fourth Reich? Just quickly to run down the names that I mentioned last week as members of the secret military, a sovereign military, I put the secret for the sovereign because they're both, it should be the SSMOM, the secret sovereign military. James Angleton of the CIA, Robert Ablanalp, Richard Nixon's friend in the Bahamas, Joseph Bettinger, who founded the Bilderberg Society, William Buckley, James Buckley, William Casey, our CIA director, Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's head of Eastern Intelligence, the chief who formed our CIA, Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS, then became the CIA, Peter Flanagan, head of Nixon's team, who then went on to work for J. Peter Grace Intelligence Operation, and Baron Hilton, Lee Iacocca from Ford Motor Company, Joseph Kennedy, the father of John and Robert and Ted, who they were not members of the organization, James Ling, John McCone, working with the Bechtel, head of the Bechtel Corporation, along with Caspar Weinberger, our Secretary of Defense, Spyros Skouras from 20th Century Fox, Michael Sindona, John Volpe, who was ambassador to Italy, Vernon Walters, the roving ambassador to every country for the Defense Department, and also a member of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, and William Clark, a very important man. There was an article about William Clark in the paper just this past week, a question or 2 weeks ago in the newspaper, about William Clark's role in Washington, D.C., and it described him as one of the most important men in Washington, D.C. at the present time, and that he also was responsible for bringing over Helene von Damm. This article is in the San Jose Mercury and also nationally in a magazine called Parade that comes out on Sundays. And William Clark is described very clearly as a devout Catholic who was in counterintelligence in Europe. He was appointed to the California Supreme Court without a law degree by Ronald Reagan. He now is director of the National Security Council. He brought over Helene von Damm, who incidentally also was brought over by Otto von Bolschwing, the man who helped the Iron Guard escape from Europe, those men that you saw on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, and I've mentioned that Nazi criminal who's been in the Silicon Valley with the Defense Department and Hewlett-Packard and working with Wilson and Turpel and the Defense, the CIA, the NASA group. He just died a few months ago, von Bolschwing. But he was instrumental in bringing over Helene von Damm, and also William Clark was supposed to. So the two in counterintelligence placed a woman in the office of Ronald Reagan to make appointments as governor. She worked for him in California 8 years, and she now has that office right next to him in the White House, the office closest to him, to help make selections for appointments. So William Clark is a member of this organization. I referred last week to a book, Real Lace, by Stephen Birmingham, published in 1973, Harper and Row, New York. And in this book, he describes the Knights of Malta. Stephen Birmingham wrote Our Crowd and a book on Dakota apartments in New York. And he writes about the wealthy upper class in various capacities. And he has one on the Irish, important Irish people in the United States, and it's titled Real Lace. And in here, in this book, he describes the Papal Order of the Knights of Malta as being the highest Catholic honor of all. And he tells how the Knights of Malta comprise what is the most exclusive club on earth. They are more than Catholic aristocracy. They are the nobility and the royalty. There are over 600 million Roman Catholics, but only 8,000 Knights of Malta. And he goes into the importance of them, that they began and were founded in the 11th century, originally as nursing monks. The Knights captured the island of Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S, by the Byzantine Empire in 1309 and called it sovereign, and they were moved out and then went to Malta. They were replaced and set up their hierarchy in Malta. They said the Knights' headquarters right now are on the Via Condotti in Rome. The Knights' scarlet and white banner flies over the huge palazzo. The Italian police say they have extraterritorial rights. They're a special group, just like the Vatican. They have their own territory in Rome. Many of you, and myself included, didn't realize that this was going on simultaneously. And it's a nation of its own, like Vatican City. Now, these leaders, some of these leaders, and there's many more that I mentioned, that just were in this one article alone, have two loyalties. One to this other society with its extraterritorial rights, and a part of the Vatican, but separate from the Vatican, because this is obviously the one who makes the military decisions of which countries are overthrown. If they influence the Bilderberg Society and the counterintelligence, and all the men I mentioned had a role, say, in overthrowing Iran and putting the Shah in and taking Mossadegh out, or Central America, the coups, and Vernon Walters in Brazil, and the United States in Dallas, and Allende murdered in Chile, they have played a role in what I once ran down was 77 military dictatorships that were overthrown, and the countries were overthrown, and military dictatorships were put into power, and that would be consistent with the role of the authority of the Vatican and of these people working for not a democracy, because a democracy makes you weak. And I have some more quotations. I had some on the air last week, and I'll give you some more of the Thinking of the Knights of Malta. Now, this book by Stephen Birmingham talks about their extraterritorial rights, and there are 35 foreign nations that have full diplomatic relations with the order. Over the centuries, Catholic kings and queens have been knights and dames of Malta. There is a mixture of Eastern and ancient European nobility, newly rich North and South Americans. Among the most prominent members are King Baudouin of Belgium, Henri d'Orléans, pretender to the throne of France, and Irishman J. Peter Grace, the Honorable D.J. Moore, I mentioned him last week, the ambassador to Ireland, and Danny Thomas, who built a $2 million hospital, St. Jude, in Memphis, Tennessee. This book says, for years, the Knights of Malta maintained a semi-secrecy about their membership and activities. They're rarely photographed. They put on their hats. They're festooned with ostrich plumes, golden spurs, uniforms with gold epaulettes, sashes, ribbons, medals, and decorations. They're well known for their fundraising activities. They have kept their sights focused firmly on the order's ancient military past. You better believe that. With Angleton and Galen and Casey and Allen, the National Security Council, and the list of who's who. And Vernon Walters and J. Peter Grace, the military branch. Birmingham very gently says that their activities are based on their ancient military past, that they took the island, they drove the knights from the island of Rhodes in 1522, the Turkish fleet, and then the knights took over the island of Malta and fended the Islam off and made a Christian Europe. And he goes on to describe that the Reformation and the rise of European nationalism stripped the order of some of its temporal power, and the papacy was to take its bold defenders back under its wing. So these are the defenders of the Vatican, and the Knights of Malta have been incorporated into the military decision-making branch of the United States Army. Now, every soldier and every officer is not a Catholic. Every person who enlists in the Army is not a Catholic, but the decision-making of who goes to war or where the wars will be, whether it'll be Cuba or Salvador or Nicaragua or Chile or wherever, the decision-making is in the hands of these top people that I mentioned before. And the book by Birmingham has some more pages that I'll refer to on J. Peter Grace, because he's an interesting character. Now, this article by Coogan is fascinating. He has some footnotes here about Father Walsh, the anti-communist from Georgetown University that I mentioned him last week, and his links to a Major General Karl Haushofer, the world's best-known geopolitician in Germany. And he mentions Avery Dulles. That's where I left off last week in this article, talking about Avery Dulles. And the article says that it's very seldom mentioned, the right-wing group of Malta, the Georgetown group. Avery Dulles' name is never in print, with one exception, a book, Tracing Martin Bormann, mentioned him by Bezymensky, Bezymensky, I, Bezymensky, Tracing Martin Bormann. And in that book, it mentions that John Foster Dulles, he was Secretary of the State during the Eisenhower administration, and his brother, Alan Dulles, became the first director of the CIA after recruiting and making deals in Switzerland from 1943 to 45 with Nazis who would be pouring into the United States when the war was over and even while the war was going on. And he says in this article, no one has touched Avery Dulles in print except this one book. But in this book, it tells how Martin Bormann met with Bishop Udell, H-U-D-A-L, in Rome, in the Via della Pace. Udell was the guardian of not only of Martin Bormann, brother Martin Bormann of the church, but another monk, Brother Avery, John Foster Dulles' son. Udell told Martin he could join Otto Skorzeny, who set up the Odessa, the Thousand-Year Reich. He could go to Spain, or he could go with Adolf Eichmann in Argentine, and he chose to go Bormann to Argentine to be with Eichmann. So where I left off last week were the role, the strong henchman with Bormann, who, through the Catholic Church, who sent Bormann down to Argentine. But it doesn't end because Dulles is, this particular Avery Dulles, is based at Georgetown University now, the one who went along and escorted Borman out. And he recently was the Vatican man at the World Council of Churches. They met in Peru. Now, one of the law offices, a member of the law office of Bolan, Sachs, Bacon, and Bolan, B-O-L-A-N, Tom Bolan, is a member of the Knights of Malta, the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. Tom Bolan is one of the leading figures of the Knights of Bolan, of Malta, according to Coogan. And this law firm is the law firm of Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn and David Shine were the two men that worked along with Senator Joe McCarthy in looking for communists in the State Department. Those were the two upfront Jews of the whole organization that were used, just as Bernard Weissman was used for William Buckley and the Young Americans for Freedom as a cover for the people really behind the assassination of John Kennedy. They like to use Jews as a cover, and Roy Cohn goes gracefully for that part. Incidentally, not only was Senator Joe McCarthy pushed into prominence by Father Walsh and J. Edgar Hoover with his Cold War at home tearing Americans against America, but David Shine owns and did own, still owns, the Ambassador Hotel where Robert Kennedy was murdered. And that murder made it possible for Richard Nixon to win the presidency in 1968. That June 5th, 1968 murder of Senator Robert Kennedy was in the hotel owned by David Shine, who would have the access to every doorway and hall. Remember, the excuse for not being a conspiracy in the murder of Robert Kennedy was nobody knew which entrance he would leave from. It was an obscure pantry. Well, every pantry could have had an assassin in it. The Soldiers of Fortune tells you how these security guards are placed as guards, as mercenaries around presidents and prominent officials. And so David Shine was a partner with Roy Cohn and Senator Joe McCarthy, funded from Father Welsh from Georgetown. And Tom Bolan, the head of the law office that Roy Cohn is associated with, is a member of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. Bolan also was the top advisor to U.S. Senator Al D'Amato, and Roy Cohn is the connection to the Italian mafia. He's also written up in the Torma document the Permandex story of the team behind the murders of specifically John Kennedy and the attempted murder on Charles de Gaulle in France. The Roy Cohn is a leader of the right-wing Jewish organization, and he's part of the whole Buckley crew. Coogan describes him as part of the whole crew, working out of the office and closest to the Buckley gang, the Saxby, Colon, Bolan offices, Roy Cohn, right in there with Senator Joe McCarthy and the Sovereign Military Group, feeding them with this anti-American propaganda. Now, the Buckley crew, according to this article, was in close support with the Mossad. That's the Israeli intelligence. And many of you know that I've a long time been suspicious of the Mossad and Begin and the role of Israel with the far right wing, both in Argentina, in Taiwan, and South Africa, and in the United States. And in this article, he says that Roy Cohn not only was a link to the mafia and the right wing, but along with the Buckley crew and company, they worked with, one, the Begin government, two, with James Angleton, longtime control over the Israeli desk at the CIA, and now they've merged to a nutty right-wing Jewish team. And the question of the Mossad, the Jewish intelligence, working with the far right-wing has never, ever yet been exposed, and that is a story that is long overdue. Coogan says in this article that the Mossad has a person in Los Angeles, a right-wing Mossad man with tight Vatican South African ties. His name is Amnon Barnes, A-M-N-O-N-B-A-R-N-E-S, and he's based in Los Angeles, a millionaire, and seems to be a connecting link of the Vatican to South Africa to Israeli intelligence. On the other side of this tape, on part two, I'm going to do some more on the sovereign military a branch of the Vatican related to our CIA and to German intelligence.